Hey, this is Mike Evans. Listen to every episode of Schlereth and Evans on demand at 1043thefan.com. Presented by Siltahara Motors, the home of the zero down with Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. Regardless of your financial standing, no one should be without a vehicle. Visit the special financing section at sthmotors.com.
I am doing question mark, Millennial Ben. Presented by Brakes Plus. Ooh, I like this one. I love these kind of questions. Mark. Would you rather have Joker and Murray or Westbrook and Harden?
Oh, wow. I'd rather have Joker and Murray.
Me too.
Westbrook and Harden to me are kind of the same guy. I mean, Westbrook is just such a phenomenal athlete, you know, but I just think there are more that you can do. And they present a bigger challenge, Joker and Murray.
Well, it's not just that. It's also, I don't think that Westbrook and Harden lead like Joker and Murray do.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you that.
I don't think that they've shown in their careers that they have the kind of heart and basketball guts that Joker and Murray have shown.
Well, I think, here's what
wasn't,
I think.
Wasn't both
right.
Harden and Westbrook on that Oklahoma City team?
Yes.
That blew a 3-1 lead. And they
right.
Totally went out with a whimper against the Lakers. They won the first game and then lost 4 in a row.
Here's what I think about those two guys. They both need the ball in their hand to be effective. You know what I mean? They're both individualistic isolation basketball guys. So they can score a lot of points, right? In ISO sets and that stuff, but they're not facilitators. They don't make all the other guys around them better. They're just really good. Whereas Murray and whereas especially Joker have the ability to make everybody else good. And so it's more of an unselfish team aspect to me that they bring that Harden and Westbrook just bring more of an individualism.
To the texter who says, Nuggets versus Heat, why don't they just try marketing good basketball? If it was only that simple.
Yeah, that's very naive. It's a very naive.
Oh, sweet, sweet texter.
Mm.
Sweet.
Little fella.
Texter. You think it's as easy as that, huh?
Yeah.
To get to
wrap my big burly arm around you and give you a hug. Right? Just come in here, you little shaver.
Yeah. Because everyone's so caught up in that Dallas Stars Tampa Bay Lightning NHL final.
Yeah. Wah, wah, wah. Well, is that 1-1 right now?
That is 1-1. Now, I'm sure it's good hockey. I'm sure it's great hockey. But are you trying to tell me that...
Outside of Tampa and outside of Dallas, is anybody watching that series?
So if it was, let's say instead of Dallas and Tampa, it was the Rangers against the Blackhawks. Something tells me that series would be creating a little bit more buzz.
By the way, we'd probably have
more eyeballs watching.
Even it
matters.
Right. But even if the Avalanche have more of a national draw.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, where'd they come from originally? Quebec? And they're, you know, I mean, they just have a more of a national draw because of all that great hockey back in the 90s and 2000s. Like they have a better, there's a bigger Avalanche following. Sorry. Just is. No, you know what? I take that back. I'm not sorry.
Yeah, you don't apologize for anything.
No.
Hey, by the way, just want to pass along some sad news, but what a life, what a career. Gail Sayers passed away today at the age of 77. And, you know, when you have the argument about the greatest running backs of all time, do not ever leave Gail Sayers out of the conversation because, you know, he did not have a long career, but my goodness, just the eye test.
Gale Sayers was a very regal man. And when I was a rookie, after my rookie year, I was back home in Alaska and Gale was speaking somewhere and I actually got tickets, and I went to watch him speak. Just because I was like, you know what? There's a guy, and I was a big football fan growing up, but just the history of Gale Sayers and the Chicago Bears and you know, the whole Brian Song movie and everything else. And he was just so regal and so gracious. And I got a chance to introduce myself to him, you know, and he was very, you know, very appreciative that I came. But I just wanted to hear him speak, and I just wanted to hear his stories. And, you know, not that I even remember any of the stories. I just remember meeting him and how he treated me. And, you know, there's that saying in the Broncos locker room, you can easily judge the character of a man by how he treats those who can do nothing for him. It's in the training room. I used to read that every morning when I come in and get coffee. And he was very kind and very sweet. And so anyhow, it was just one of those moments that I remember.
All right. So Gale Sayers passing away at the age of 77. He may not be sweet, but he's certainly regal.
He is regal.
It is Joel Klatt, who joins us for his weekly chat presented by Audi Flatirons. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning. How are you guys today?
Good. I have the sense, as yesterday was the first day of fall, that you smell like a pumpkin spice latte right now.
You know what? If you want a little bit of Christmas in a cup, or even Thanksgiving in a cup, dare I say, go get a chai, one pump vanilla, one pump pumpkin spice. It's delicious.
Yes.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
It does sound delicious. Joel, when you watch a Broncos team that gave up 7 sacks and 19 quarterback hits, does it remind you of playing at CU? What goes through your head when you see?
Honestly, Mark, I can't remember if you know what I mean.
But what goes through your head when you see an offensive performance that is just that mind-boggling?
Well, you know, I get nervous for the psyche of the quarterback. How many times have we seen really good players and talented quarterbacks in the league never materialize because early in their career they were not protected well? We've seen it, you know, David Carr. Remember back when he was the first pick of the Texans? He was a really, really good player. And just got absolutely crushed because they couldn't protect him. And it just kind of ruined him. And you know, you get kind of that flinch factor where you never know exactly where they're coming from. And I think that it takes a insane amount of I don't even know, courage from a quarterback to continue to play as if that's not happening around you. And so, you know, obviously Drew's going to be out for a few weeks, and the fact of the matter is that when he comes back, let's hope that he doesn't have that flinch factor in him, because it can happen with young quarterbacks, in particular when you move up a level like this and you finally get the keys to the car. So that's really what was going through my mind when I was watching the game. I hope that this doesn't have long-term effects, not just this injury in particular, although any injury to a throwing shoulder, as I can attest, is going to affect the way that you play moving forward. But just the psychological factor of going through a game like that, is it always in the back of your mind? So I hope that this didn't do long-term damage to the pocket presence of a young, talented quarterback in Drew Lock, because that can happen. You and I both know it.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other things is not only just the pocket presence and the fear factor, because nobody wants to get hit, but the other part for me, and I watched Driscoll miss a bunch of throws because the clock in his head was so sped up that he's like, I can't wait for the corner to come open, right? I'm going to throw the flat, or I'm going to just pull it down. And there were several throws that, you know, you've got some high-low combo, like I said, some flat corner combination where the corner route, the seven's going to come wide open, and you just don't throw it. And that's another concern for me, where you've got a dynamic or a explosive play dialed up, and you can't even get to it.
When the goal of the passing game shifts from we want to attack the weakest spot in the coverage or weakest spot in the personnel, okay, two, we need to get the ball out as quickly as we can, you're doing it wrong, right? And whether that is, you know, kind of design from a play calling perspective and trying to get three step or something like that, and you know, kind of intentionally saying, how do we get the ball out of our hands as quickly as possible? And or just the psyche of the player in the pocket trying to get the ball out of his hand as quickly as possible. That doesn't, you don't win football games like that, because to win football games, you have to attack the weaknesses, whether they're structural in terms of the defense or whether they're personnel driven. And I didn't see Denver doing that. It felt like they were just calling plays to see if they could have some success. And the quarterback is trying to get, you know, Driscoll's trying to get the ball out of his hand as quickly as possible. He's not going through his progression on his clock. The timing and the mechanism of the clock within the offense and the passing game was totally off. And frankly, you're just never going to have success doing that. And that's why Mike and I used to always talk, Mark, about kind of the independence factor of contribution, right? Like which players are independent of others in terms of their contribution to the success of the unit. And when you really boil it down, as much as I'm a quarterback elitist, you can't do anything as a quarterback unless your offensive line at least has some semblance of quality play up in front of you. And right now, Denver doesn't have that. And they haven't had it for a while, by the way. This is not a new thing. How many times did we sit here last year and talk about the poor play of the offensive line? Like, this is a major problem, because it is a non-starter in terms of the success of your offense. You can't run the ball on first down. You're behind the chains on second down. Now the team defense is pinning their ears back, and your timing of the mechanisms of the passing game are not in your favor on third down. And guess what you do? You punt. And then you don't win. So they got to fix the offensive line. And I think that, to be candid, I think it's the biggest failure of the front office over the last three seasons, is that they have never addressed and gotten it right up front.
Busy with Joel Klatt. And Joel, I want to go back to what you were talking about when Locke comes back and the whole flinch factor. Even Vic Fangio came out and said Drew could have done a better job of stepping up in the pocket and perhaps avoiding that kind of a hit, that kind of injury. Is it something that is simple as, hey, learn how to be better in the pocket, learn how to manipulate the pocket, learn how to sidestep? You watch the greats and you watch a guy like Manning, you watch a guy like Brady, there can be all kinds of stuff swirling around, but once they're in that almost protected bubble of the pocket, they seem, you know, still at ease. So is that something that a guy like Locke can learn, will eventually learn, or is it something that as a quarterback you either have it or you don't?
Well, unfortunately, I believe it's more of the latter, which is that you have it or you don't. Now, some would argue that you can absolutely get better, and I think that that's the case. But the ability to understand the spacing of the pocket, I think, is more what it's about, right? And Mark will attest to this. There are guys that just understand. It's called a pocket for a reason, right? It's not just a line that you can back up from. Because of the way a rush happens, the way the tackles are expecting the quarterback to behave in the pocket, that pocket, it can collapse around you but still be a pocket, right? And the greats understand that, and they can be calm within that chaos. I think a lot of young quarterbacks in particular that come out of offenses that didn't have a ton of timing mechanisms within them and at the college level, which this is what I've always been critical of Locke about, was his college system. What they tend to do is back up. I think it's one of the worst things that a quarterback can do is back up once he has set up in the deepest part of his drop. You don't want to back up. At most, you want to move forward. And those hitch steps to move forward, Mike, are the timing of the passing game. Think about it this way. If you're on a progression read, let's say it's man coverage and you're on a progression read, okay? I'm going to get back to the end point of my drop, and I'm reading number one, right? Is number one open? No. Hitch step, number two. Hitch step, number three. Hitch step, number four. And now I better be gone, because three hitch steps, and that rush is going to get to me. That's the timing of the offense. That's the mechanism that a quarterback needs to use to protect himself. So if you're backing up as a quarterback, you don't have, one, that timing mechanism. Two, you're making it a longer throw. Three, you don't have your base under you so that you can't throw, at least in my estimation, a ball to the best of your ability with the foundation of your base under you. Everything bad that can happen does happen when a quarterback backs up. And that has been Drew's at time bugaboo is that he will back up a step, two steps, and try to escape the rush that way versus sitting in the design pocket and trying to be calm within that chaos that ensues around you. That offensive line is expecting you to sit in that pocket and be calm. That's the way they're trying to block. And so when Vic Fangio says, yes, Drew Lock has some culpability in this, he's absolutely right. And any offensive line will tell you that if a quarterback backs up, man, you're on your own. You're basically throwing the keys out the door and you're saying, I'm on my own.
Yeah, and not that our tackles understand this, but most tackles understand that, you know, I'm going to push you by at 11 yards. My quarterback better not be any deeper than 9.5 to 10 yards because that's what you're taught to do. It's interesting to me to talk to you about stepping up in the pocket. There's this sense, and I'm with you. I've always believed that great pass rushers were born, not made. You can always get better, but the great ones just seem to have something special about them, a special feel, whatever it is, right? And I always thought this about quarterbacks as well. There is that special guy that can climb that pocket like you talked about with a hitch here, you know, even a hitch, but as you're sliding to the right or sliding to the left, that feel that rush, but don't look at it. And then there's the guy that climbs the pocket and is constantly looking at, where are they coming from? Like that to me is the part, Joel, that is kind of your innate. It's born. It's something that you just have.
I couldn't agree with you more. And there's something about I've tried to describe it before. And to your point, it's hard to describe without just saying, listen, this is an innate thing. I will tell you that at least from my experience and when I talk to guys that either coach it really well or do it really well, one of the things that is common within the guys that have great pocket presence, the ability to step up and be unaware of the rush around them, is that their eyes and more importantly, their focus mentally is on what's happening in the passing game structure with your five wide receivers or free releases or whatever it is. The guys that are too concerned about what's happening in protection generally are the ones that don't do it well, right? So it can be boiled down. And listen, this is not proven out. I'm just saying that through years of talking with guys, it seems to me that the ones that are more innately focused on what's happening in the passing game are better in the pocket versus the guys that are more focused on how they're being protected. And I think I don't know how you change that mindset. If I did, I would certainly not be calling games for a living. I'd have some sort of ridiculous contract as a college head coach, I can tell you that.
Yeah, and you'd give great press conferences, too.
Oh, yeah. They'd be the best.
I mean, you're welcome.
Visiting with Joel Klatt as we visit with Joel each and every week, presented by Audi Flatirons. Of course, Joel, lead college football analyst for Fox Sports. College football right now, it's certainly chaotic. Is it a beautiful chaos, or is it just chaos?
No, yeah, it's just chaos. And it's frustrating, and, you know, I think there's a lot of redundancies, and this is what happens when you don't have, you know, kind of a singular overarching governing body over just that sport. You know, the NCAA is never going to be that because they're trying to govern all levels and all sports. So what's good for major college football is certainly not good for Division II college volleyball, right? So the NFL is doing this so well because they have that overarching governing body. And when you look at college, just to give you some perspective, did you know that it's basically up to each university and really their local municipalities exactly how they're handling contact tracing? Well, I mean, does that make sense? One team in the Big 12 is handling it a little bit differently than another team. Certainly teams at lower levels that don't have the resources aren't testing quite as much, and therefore their protocols are far different than other schools. So that I think that this chaos is proving to be revealing in terms of the problems and the structural cracks within the sport that I love. And the contact tracing is what's really been proven out to be so difficult for these schools. And it should be noted, and I think celebrated to a large extent, that even with some of these positive tests and postponements and cancellations, guys, that, you know, the overwhelming and vast vast majority of positive tests are completely asymptomatic. The kids wouldn't even have any idea that they have it, which, to the point of being safer within the structure of football versus with, you know, outside of the structure of football, if those players contracted the virus in the normal course of life, which is very, I would say, likely, versus within the confines of football, and they were asymptomatic, they would be unknowing spreaders of the virus. So if your goal is just to, quote unquote, stop the spread, then getting these tests, I think, is very beneficial. But what happens, and this is where it just decimates a team, is that if they're saying, hey, I was around, you know, I was around Evans and Schlereth and DeHuff yesterday, and I tested positive today. It doesn't matter how many negative tests you three have. You still have to isolate for 14 days. You can't test out of contact tracing, which to me is madness, right? It's like madness. So when you see these postponements, it's not because of some wild outbreak in these programs that kids are coughing all over each other and having problems and so on and so forth. In almost every single case, it's two or three kids that have zero symptoms at all, get a positive test, contact trace 7, 8 to 10 others, and then those kids can't test out of the contact tracing. Therefore, they're done for 14 days and whole position groups are decimated. So in my estimation, the cure is way worse than the disease in college football. We think it's really bad, but it's not, based on protocols and what's going on. So we'll see how the season kind of moves forward, but I certainly think that the NFL has done it better with those contact tracing wristbands. I think you have a much better idea of what's going on, and I think that their testing protocols are better as well.
Yeah, well, I know one thing. If that was the case here in studio, that DeHuff would have quarantined himself long, long before anybody even mentioned the contact tracing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It had been 35 days, just to be sure.
Yeah. Just to
I just
sure.
feel
just
bad
sure.
for DeHuff's kids. He was the one having to teach them in virtual school. I mean, God help them.
Yeah, yeah, they're probably a grade level behind right now. Poor kids.
What game at you least, get this? What game you get this this week?
I'm supposed to do Kansas State at Oklahoma, but we have now resorted to backup games. So I'm making two charts just in case,
and
there's Texas Tech at hosting Texas as well.
The good news, though, Joel, the good news is you don't have 90 players with double numbers. So that's good
right.
news. Yeah. Hey, man, I swear to you, I can't even keep track of the NFL guys. Like, I got to have my own spotter, for crying out loud. Who's that? What's his name?
And then we go all the way back to what you said initially about my college days and getting hit in the head. And now I've got to do it.
It's maddening.
What's that?
I'm a wreck.
What's that coffee again you recommend?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
The coffee you recommended at the start of the
chai.
The chai pump. One pump. What is it?
Thanksgiving in a cup, Mike.
Yeah.
It's chai. One pump vanilla. One pump pumpkin spice. You're welcome.
It's beautiful.
Thanksgiving in a cup. See you, Joel.
See you, bud.
Later.
Joel Klatt, presented by Audi Flatirons. And Joel and all our guests appearing on the Fireball Hotline. As will be the case coming up with George Karl. Cannot wait to pick the coach's brain on what happened last night. He called it. He said the Nuggets would win game 3. Why was he so confident? He'll tell us next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. People care about 3 things when buying a vehicle. Number 1, price. Siltahar Motors has the best prices and financing options that fit everyone's current credit and financial situation. Get 0 down and 0% financing for 72 months. Number 2, selection. Siltahar's 5 dealers in 1 offering Ford, Lincoln, Mazda, Volvo, and Maserati with hundreds of new and used cars, trucks, and SUVs on the lot. And number 3, location. Siltahar's right off Highway 36 in Wadsworth, or view their entire selection online at sthmotors.com. Siltahar Motors. Get everything you want out of a dealership.
Shame on anybody who really doubted whether or not the Nuggets would respond after that gut punch loss in game 2. Come on. Have you not learned anything about this team throughout life in the bubble? George Karl believed in the Nuggets so much so that he came out and predicted a win before game 3. The coach joins us now, presented by Bet Rivers Sportsbook, McGill's Hotel and Casino. Coach, why did you feel so confident in the Nuggets' ability to bounce back last night?
Well, a lot of it was because of what they've done in the last two series. When they get angry, they get intense, they get focused, they demand more of their inner discipline. And I'm not in love with the Lakers. I'm sorry. I'm just not. Maybe it's my history with them, but they're good. LeBron's on the mission. But do you trust Anthony Davis? Do you trust the other guys off their bench? I think it's about the others a lot in this series. And I like Denver's bench better than I like the Lakers bench. And they were physical with Anthony Davis, and he kind of backed off. And LeBron, when you make him play half court and make him shoot jump shots, he has some flaws. So I'm not saying Denver is going to surprise the world, but I was actually sitting with a Los Angeles Clipper coach last night watching the game, John Welsh, who was my assistant here in Denver for 8 years. And we were watching the game, and he said, "We weren't afraid of the Lakers. We didn't think the Lakers were that tough, and we thought Denver actually gave us some more trouble than we thought with them." So I think the Denver Nuggets are getting a lot of national recognition, but they got a hell of a challenge ahead of them. But as of now, I feel it's somewhat of an even series.
You know, George, you talked about the others, and I was talking earlier about catalytic games, you know, things that put you on the map or things that really increase your confidence as a player. And I looked at Grant last night and what he was able to do, getting to the free throw line, getting double teamed. I mean, Grant's getting double teamed, and he's splitting double teams and making passes. He was a huge difference maker. Is this one of those games that you just build upon, and maybe he becomes that reliable third scorer that the Nuggets have really been looking for?
That would be great. If he could step up to being a 15-point and maybe 20-point guy, a consistent guy, that would be another step forward for the Nuggets. You know, Jeremy Grant is a great athlete. When he first came in the league, he played in this league because of his athleticism. And I thought what he did last night, I'd like him to see him do it every night. Instead of just becoming a jump shooter and a three-point corner shooter, he was more than that. He was attacking the rim. He was catching, going, and getting to the free throw line 12 times with any player is a big-time plus in playoff basketball. And he just had a pizzazz to him, both when he was covering Anthony Davis, he was feisty. He was more physical than the game before. When he was on LeBron, he seemed like he kept him in front of him more often than he had done in the past. Right now, I think you make LeBron take two-point jump shots, keep him from the rim, keep him off the free throw line. I think that's a big plus. And make Anthony Davis beat you. And if that's the case, I like Jokic and Murray as much as I like Anthony Davis.
Busy with George Karl. And Coach, man, when you talk about watching the game with the Clippers assistant, your longtime assistant, John Welsh, I would have loved to have been just be able to sit there and listen to the conversation back and forth. I'm curious, did he share with you anything from the Clippers' perspective about what they perceived of the Nuggets and what they learned about the Nuggets through the course of that seven-game series?
I think the one thing he was hyped up on a lot was they thought they could run the Denver Nuggets, and they did. And transition defense is where the Nuggets now are kind of finding that in the NBA, if you make any team play 5-on-5, you can defend them. And I think a lot of this game, and John Welsh was talking about how they thought they could run them off the court and did it in some of the games, but as Denver got better at getting back and making them play 5-on-5, the Clippers got worse. And come game 7, the pressure and stress of a 3-1, blowing a 3-1 lead, the Clippers collapsed, and Denver was somewhat dominating. And I don't know, I don't want to say this too loud, but for 6 quarters, Denver has been dominating in this Lakers series.
Yeah, they certainly have, and they certainly seem to have a great shot here. My feeling, George, is they need to lose this next game so they can be down 3-1 with their backs against the wall. Because what is it about this team? They've shown an incredible amount of resiliency, right? And just overall, like, they have out-toughed
their opponents. That's the thing that is most intriguing and most exciting to me, is they've been tougher than the Clippers. They were tougher than Utah. And right now, you know, they've got a chance to be tougher than the Lakers.
I think the game is going to get more physical. I think Anthony Davis understands having no rebounds, and he backed off the game a little bit, and Denver was much more physical with them, you know, much more body to body rather than trying to stay in front of them. They challenged him physically, and I think he's going to continue. You know, LeBron got hit a couple times. I'm sure that's going to be somewhat continued. I think it's going to be a feisty series, and it's going to be good. It's going to be fun to watch.
I love the adjustments that go on during the course of a long series, so I'm going to ask for some really good inside X's and O's talk here. The Lakers looked like they were struggling with the Nuggets' high pick-and-roll game, and they went to more of a zone look as they were coming back. And Michael Malone, after the game, said, hey, you know, we're going to go back to work. We got to work on our zone. So what kind of adjustment are we seeing here? Do you expect to see more of that from the Lakers tomorrow night? And do you think the Nuggets are equipped to deal with it?
Well, I think the Lakers did find something with the zone. I think you'll see more of that. I think it's going to be an interesting way. They're going to where Jokic is at the high post, and they cover him with a guard and double team out of his zone principle rather than man-to-man. That will be more. But the thing that everybody should be aware of, the turnover has become a big part of this series. The team that turns it over and gives up a lot of points and turnover points has had more success than the other team. And what I liked about the game last night was at the end of the game, and when they came back at you and cut it to three and missed a three-pointer to tie it, you know, Murray again, and Murray and Jokic have been tremendous in the fourth quarter. And I also think, you know, the defense of Denver made them shoot jump shots. And some of them were wide open jump shots. But I think that's the way Denver's got to play. They got to crowd Anthony Davis, beat him up a little bit, grab and hold him a little bit, keep LeBron from the paint, keep LeBron from the rim, make him shoot as many two-pointers as you want to shoot from mid-range. They only shoot about 36% from mid-range, and they're actually shooting lower than that in this series.
All right. Well, it sounds like a great game plan. George, thank you so much, man. We always love talking to you, and we'll talk to you after the next Nuggets victory. How about that?
I think, you know, I'm gonna, let me look around and let me read the papers a little bit. But as I've said on both the Clippers series and this series, the Denver Nuggets are closer to being equal than what sometimes what they get pronounced.
All right. That's good. I love it. Thank you, Coach. George okay. Carl, thanks, join thanks. Us. He's presented by Bet River Sportsbook, McGill's Hotel and Casino. Now, I know how this is being spun by Laker fan, and there could be some legitimacy to this, is that, hey, you know, the Lakers let up. They thought they had delivered the death knell punch.
Yes.
with the game winner. They were up two games to none and they relaxed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I was looking at it from a Laker perspective, I would pass off those first three quarters as a team that wasn't really into it, a team that wasn't really mentally sharp. LeBron either looked tired, maybe the Nuggets perspective, or bored,
mm-hmm.
the Laker fan perspective. And it wasn't until the fourth quarter that they, you know, got activated.
Yeah.
So, I'm curious to see, because I know how the Nuggets are going to come out tomorrow in game four. I want to see if the Lakers come out and clearly are a different team, or are they starting to get that look that the Jazz started to take on, or that the Clippers started to take on, that look of, uh-oh, they figured us out. They got a plan. And we're not exactly sure we can counter that plan. Do they start to get that look in their eyes and their body language that we saw with the Jazz and the Clippers?
Right.
That's what's going to be fascinating to me tomorrow night.
See, it's almost, I don't even know that it's that they have a plan. I think it's more like in the first Rocky.
Right? You're stealing that from me. Will you at least give me credit first before you go down this road?
I think it's more like the first Rocky, where Rocky keeps pulling himself off the canvas, and Apollo Creed keeps looking and just going, "Really? Are you guys are getting up again? You're getting up again? Did you come up with that?
I did come up with that.
Are you sure?
I did.
It feels like a totally naturally, like I just came up with that.
You stole that.
Well, I mean, then
but I'm used to it.
You are my intellectual property.
I'm used
We've
to it.
Established that. So
I'm used to that.
I'm entitled to whatever you say becomes my intellectual property and my content.
Coming up next, story time with Stink, and a story that if you are a Bronco fan and still look back with warm feelings to Super Bowl 32 and that upset win over the Packers, you have got to listen to this next story with Stink. Coming up next. You know, lost in the curiosity I had of what your conversation with Tom Brady was like last week as you prepared for the Bucks and the Panthers.
Panthers, yes.
Was you dropping this little nugget that you had a long conversation about Super Bowl 32 with Brett Favre, who was at the game.
Yeah.
So let's all sit back, grab a comfortable spot. Sit crisscross applesauce style, and let's listen to a little story time with Stink.
So
we really need an open for this, by the way.
Yeah.
The Huff and Ben.
So Brett is doing some kind of special for NFL Films. He's traveling around. I think he's just kind of enjoying games, and you know, and so NFL Films reached out to Fox and said, "Hey, can we get Stink and Brett together?" And so. I was like, yeah, have him just come up to the booth, you know, before the game and let's just chop it up. And so we just chopped it up about a lot of things, just football in general and stuff. And so he brought up Super Bowl 32. And as soon as he brought it up, I said, I'm not going to apologize. And he goes, and I don't expect you to. And, we just kind of laughed about that game. And he's like we had beating you, like we were the best defense and the best run defense and the biggest defense, and you guys were small and this, that, and the other. And he goes, did you have any doubt? Did you guys have any doubt that you could run the ball against us? Because we just felt like there's no way you're going to be able to. And I was like, there was never any doubt on our part. I said, you know, I'll go back to 1996 when we went up to your guys' place and got our asses handed to us in Green Bay in December. And he goes, I remember the game. And I go, yeah, you know, we had started a young left tackle. I had just had knee surgery, although I played. We were minus TD didn't play. Aaron Craver started at running back. Bill Musgrave started at quarterback. We were decimated by injuries, and we'd already locked everything up. So we had guys getting surgeries, resting up, getting ready for the playoffs. And so I go, we got our ass kicked, yeah, but we were like, you guys saw our JV team. You didn't even see our real team. And so we felt like you guys were a little bit overconfident. And then I was telling them about kind of what they did from just a schematic standpoint when anytime that you ran slot against them. Now, slot is essentially a base formation where both the Z and the X receiver line up on the same side. So the Z goes from the strong side over to the weak side and gets in the middle. So that would be Eddie McCaffrey, the Z receiver, in the middle, Rod Smith on his outside. So we got into slot. So we'd get into whether it was weak right slot or strong right slot or red slot, you know, red right slot or whatever it was. We would get into that formation and I go, and we ran strong handoff. And anytime we got the slot, I was like, your guys' outside linebacker, Brian Williams, would extend to take away any slants. And you basically were running an exchange between Brian and Leroy Butler, who became actually the weak side linebacker. You guys exchanged that because Brian Williams could really run. And I go, we watched film. Mike Shanahan put the film on. And we watched as an offense. And play after play, anytime somebody got in those formations, Leroy Butler's down in the backfield making tackles. And, you know, the guard is off chasing the linebacker who's actually in coverage. So we just switched it and just absolutely scrambled, you know, Leroy Butler's, it was just scrambling his brains, you know. And we just got those cutbacks, and they were just huge, and they were there every single time. And we're just cutting you guys up. And Brett, the whole time, is looking at this and goes, I get done kind of telling the whole story about how we game plan for them. He goes, did we ever change it up? That's what he said. I said, not that I remember. You never change it up. And he just like shook his head. He's like, damn, like we could have been back to, we could have been the back to back world champions in the 90s. Said it was us, you know, it was us and obviously the Cowboys.
So did he admit to them taking you guys for granted, overlooking you, thinking it was going to be, did they buy the hype that they were a two touchdown favorite?
They bought the hype in that they didn't think, even though we ran the ball against everybody, they didn't think, and they were overconfident based upon the previous year's matchup. They didn't think we'd be able to run it. They didn't think we'd be able to move Gilbert Brown. They didn't think we'd be able to move Reggie White. They didn't think we'd be able to move any of those guys off the ball. Santana Dotson. So they just didn't believe that we were going to be able to run it. And if we couldn't run it, they were like, then the play action stuff is not good. They, like, we're going to beat them. So they were very confident in their ability to take us on, you know, and ability to
shut How'd that
us
work
down.
Out?
Yeah, it didn't work out good for them. But it was, it's great. It was fun to reminisce with Brett. And since I didn't really know him as players, I mean, knew of him and watch him, didn't really know him as a player, but I've gotten to do several events with him over the last couple of years. And he's just a fun dude, man. He's a fun dude to reminisce about. We walked me through all the nickel versus dime versus, you know, that whole thing with, Ty Detmer, cause he didn't know what nickel was. And he walked me through that story, which just makes me laugh every time I think about it or hear about it. And he was just like, he goes, when he first got there, like he was from, you know, I mean, he ran Wishbone in high school, you know, and then Southern Miss. And then they run just a complete, you know, the run and shoot when he's in Atlanta
with
for
Glanville,
a year.
Glanville, right?
Yeah. And he goes, I didn't even know what I was doing there. And he goes, when I first got to Green Bay, he goes, Holmgren wanted me to call out the fronts. Is it a 34? Is it a 35 defense? Is it 25, 57? Is it a 56? You know what? And Brett's like, I don't know. I'm like, I can't do all that. Like, I mean, he wanted to call out the fronts because I didn't even know nickel was or dime. He's like, I don't know what dime was. Dime, what's that mean? Because there's still 11 bodies out there. Last time I checked, who cares what the numbers are? They're either 11 or there's not 11, you know? So we started talking about just things that coaches make you do, like trying to identify the mic. And I told him, I was like, you know, some guys are trying to memorize numbers. Like, here's the guys that play mic. Well, what if both those guys get hurt that you've memorized the number and somebody else comes and plays? How are you going to identify? And I told him, I go, I always told young guys, can you count to two? Because if you can count to two, you can figure out who the mic is, right? Number one outside linebacker is either the Willers, the Sam. The next guy in is the Mike. It's pretty much 100%. Like, it doesn't matter what their numbers are. Don't start, quit memorizing numbers. So we just kind of laughed about football in general. It was fun. It was fun to catch up.
So who did you enjoy talking to more? Brett Favre or Tom Brady?
I love Tom Brady! Well, I mean, you know, Tom Brady is, I enjoyed our conversation, Brett and I's conversation, immensely. But Brady, I just sat on pins and needles and listened to the dulcet tones of his explanation of the wonderful science that is football.
Josh asks a question.
Yeah.
Mark, am I going to have to keep my children away from the TV this Sunday? When you're calling a game with Tom Brady on the field, should I go in my room and put a tie on the door?
You might, yeah, that may be, you know, I mean, I got accused last week of,
you heard from Panther fans.
Oh, Panther fan was not happy with me. One Panther fan was like, are you sleeping with Tom Brady? I was like, God, I wish. But, no.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Boy, I don't know. Monday could be very awkward around here.
You think I could get kicked out of the circle?
I think Bronco fan, if the Broncos don't win and don't play well, and it's...
And I'm praising
oh,
the...
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
But what are you supposed to do, Mike?
I don't know, but I'm just...
We might have to discuss it.
Monday might require letters and circles and all kind of apologies and all that kind of stuff, because I see where this could potentially be going.
Yeah.
All right.
Be bad.
We're done. Mark will be doing a much more film study of the Broncos as he gets into preparing for the Bucks and the Broncos on Sunday. So can't wait to get more of your observations about what you're seeing from the Broncos thus far. In the meantime, we turn it over to Sandy and the not so big O, the shrinking big O, the little O next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. Siltahar Motors understands sometimes bad things happen to good people. That includes bankruptcy. If that is you, you can still purchase a car at Siltahar with zero money down in almost all cases. This is a program they've been doing for 25 years. The dealership itself is almost 60. Family-owned business that is proud of their reputation and proud to be a huge part of the Broomfield community. If you file bankruptcy, Siltahar Motors can help. Zero down and no payments for 45 days in almost all cases. Contact Team Zero Down at 720-446-9222 or online at sthmotors.com.